Today on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club, we talk with Fort Myers' own Artis Henderson. When Artis was just 5 years old, the small plane she was riding in crashed with her beloved father, Lamar, at the controls. Lamar died and Artis survived. The family never talked much about the accident, and Artis and her mother moved back to Florida, essentially smudging out the memory of Lamar. As Artis got older, she had more and more questions about her father and what happened in that plane crash. In her second memoir, No Ordinary Bird, she investigates her own family and finds many of those answers. The book is full of adventure and shocking discoveries, and at bottom, it's a daughter's search for the truth. Artis Henderson, welcome to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. So you're a journalist yourself. Did you ever consider having somebody else write this story?
Well, that's a big first question. Oh, good night. I thought we were going to ease into this. No. Well, okay, did I? No. More the opposite in the sense that when I thought about writing it, I did not think that I would be in it. So the initial versions of it, the very, very initial version was as a novel, which was terrible, but had to be done. And then the sort of next version was a very just straight biography of my father. And then it was only after I worked on that for a while did I sort of understand that I had to be in the book. So it always had to be me that wrote it, but the form changed over the process.
Oh, that's so interesting. Did you try a novel first because it was just like a way in, or...
That's a great question. Well, there are two answers to that. Well, maybe three. I'll just talk and then. I've written two books now, and I've come to understand that this is just my process, is that it's, you know, both of these memoirs are about very serious, upsetting topics, upsetting for me. I'm a very personal person. I'm quite guarded. Not in my books. I mean, my books are almost ridiculously exposing. But in conversation with me, now that these books are in the world, people have said to me, oh, I had no idea. And I was like, yeah, I don't talk about these things. So I think, yes, I start with a novel because it just is inconceivable to approach these very vulnerable topics as a straight memoir. I can't do it. So I think it's part of my process. That's the initial phase. And then I think... in a way, it's like we have to trick ourselves into writing a memoir, because I think the best memoirists tend to be very private people. And it's almost impossible for us to just sit down and be like, this is my memoir. So we have to come at it sideways. And for me, that felt, I don't know, the safest sideways approach.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's also, I think this happens in any kind of writing, but like the writer is the last to know kind of what you're writing about.
Yes. Why is that? Why are writers so perceptive in so many ways? And yes, I wasn't the one who knew it was a memoir. It was women from my longtime writing group who were with me through the first memoir. And they were like, yeah, you're writing another memoir. I was like, God, please no.
Wow. Well, I am glad you took the plunge both times, because both of your memoirs they're really extraordinary, and they go very deep. And I always want to ask memoir writers, has your family read the book? Have you gotten any pushback? Have you gotten any negative response or positive response? Or
one of the sort of miraculous things that came out of this book for me was how I found my family. I mean, that was one of the really beautiful parts, right? I mean, it's this sort of search for the truth about my father and his death. But really, it was a search for my family that I lost after he died. When the book was in the final stages of edits, but at a time when I could still make changes, I sent, you know, a copy to basically everyone who's named in the book, not everyone. Some names were changed, and so those names that, you know, they didn't necessarily get a shot. But anyways, my family did read it at a time when I could still cut things in case, in case there was trouble. But
yeah,
everyone's been absolutely, absolutely amazing.
Oh,
so generous.
Wow.
Yeah, so generous and kind. And yeah, I'm always amazed by people.
You were looking into your father's business, his history. How did you go about that? I mean, it seems like that might have been hard things to find.
Sure. Yeah, it's really hard. Because my father was quite a big smuggler and his case was a big case, you know, there's a ton of primary source information out there. So tons of newspaper articles and, you know, those I found through, you know, a combination of online and is it newspapers.com, you know, online archives. But people had saved them. You know, it's almost like people knew at some point these would be important. So, you know, I have a lot of the online articles, but I have a lot of, you know, newspapers from small newspapers that people just kept. And so if that, you know, my sister Jen, who is just an amazing human being, one of the really incredible things that she did was she put in a Freedom of Information Act request for information about our father soon after he died. I mean, she was 17.
Wow.
It's like amazing. So she had that, you know, she had those. I mean, they didn't really give her anything useful, but it was still interesting. It's more than they gave me, to be honest. So, you know, people had just been saving this. Photos of the plane crash. My Uncle Tony had those. So the National Transportation Safety Board report, he had, you know, an original copy. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really something. And just to fill listeners in, because in case they haven't read the book yet, it was, you knew your father was a pilot, but you didn't know until later that he was a drug smuggler.
No, that's right. I mean, I had a sense, you know. I mean, I think kids have really incredible perceptive abilities. So though with my child's brain, I didn't really understand the scope of what was being discussed. You know, I would hear people in other rooms use words that I felt, you know, that other kids weren't using, words like, you know, prosecutor, indictment. So I had a sense, but not the full understanding, and no one ever spoke to me about it, ever.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Artis Henderson. She's author of a new memoir, No Ordinary Bird. You alluded to this a little bit at the beginning, but you wrote in your book that your family kind of became more isolated after your father died. I wonder if you can talk a bit about that. I know just from reading, I know that you had lived in Georgia and your grandparents were on the property. And then after your dad died, your mom moved you back to Florida. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So you were kind of on your own.
Yeah, at that point, you know, it's just my mom and I, because though I talk about my brothers and sister, they're half siblings. So they're, you know, from my father's first marriage to his first wife. And so though we share a father, we don't share a mother. So I'm my mother's only child. So, you know, it was just us. We moved to Fort Myers Beach, which is where I grew up, you know, back when Fort Myers Beach was just a small shrimping community. Yeah, you know, my grandparents lived in Clewiston. My mom's from Clewiston, but they both passed away pretty, you know, within a few years after we moved down. And my mom made a very conscious decision to sort of cut out most of the people that had been involved in my dad's business. And, you know, I sort of say in the book, you know, this wasn't like Ocean's 11. You know, you recruit, you know, my dad sort of recruited from the people he knew, you know, his friends and family, basically. So that meant that then, you know, after everyone was indicted, the people who were indicted were everyone we knew. So, you know, my mom cut out those people, which was relatively easy because a lot went to prison. A few of them died. She crafted a new life for us, I think, you know, in large part to keep us safe.
When you were a young kid, were you much in touch with your half siblings or not really? Did that come when you were older?
Yes and no. So so my sister Jennifer, who's 10 years older than I am, yes, like we were close. And yes, I would see her. She would come stay with us. But, you know, they didn't. She lived with her mom, you know, on the other coast. So, and then my brother, Bill, who's 20 years older than I am, yes, close and would see him. But also, you know, he lived in Maryland, had his own life, you know, went to medical school, had children. So would see him, but, you know, geographically we were far apart. But my brother, Terry, we weren't close to, I wasn't close to at all. He had been involved in my father's business. And so he was one of the people who was cut out of my life. And so, no, I didn't know him at all. And then through the process of this book, yeah, we reconnected and he is amazing and he's been a gift and his wife is amazing.
There's something that I was thinking when I read your book, and I don't know, this may not apply to you, but it was, you know, your father was smuggling marijuana mostly, right?
Yeah, my understanding, it was all marijuana.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And today, marijuana is so accepted. I mean, whenever I go to New York, it's all I can smell. You know, somebody, one of the players at the U.S. Open, one of the tennis players, said he could smell weed as he was playing on in Arthur Ashe Stadium. I mean, that's how pervasive it is and legal in many places. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that. Like, this was such a big deal. I mean, it was a big deal and it was a big crime. But now, would it be such a crime? And like, the times have changed so much. I'm just wondering kind of what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the complicated elements of this story, right? Is, yeah, I mean, it's weed. Like, you know, so many people smoke weed. But, you know, but it's also that's, you know, this, it's such a product of that era, this discussion, right? Because, you know, my father's attorney, Jeffrey Bogart, who I met through the process of this book and who's also just amazing. You know, one of the things he told me then was that, you know, at that time in the late 70s and early, well, not so much the late 70s, early 80s after Reagan came to office, you know, people who were involved with marijuana, who smoked it, who transported it, who sold it, they were considered worse than murderers. Worse. And, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions, right? One can ask around that, like why the need to do that? The other thing, let me just say, I'm not even sure this is really answering that question, but you know, one of the things that my father always said was, I was just the transportation guy. Okay, I mean, so like, I mean, it was a big transportation guy, but like, you know, he didn't grow it, he didn't sell it. I mean, I don't know, that doesn't really make it better or worse, but
yeah. I know it is very complicated, but I have another question kind of related to that, because in your book you write, my dad's moral code was defined in terms that I will never fully understand. He saw himself as a good guy, yet he wasn't above associating with bad guys if they could help him in some way. Talk about that. Like, have you been able to come to terms with that, or how do you feel about all that?
Yeah, this is my trouble, right? Is like, how do I feel? I don't know. I mean, I think I just wrote a 200-page book trying to figure it out, right? Like, how I, God, I mean, the you know, the pat answer is, it's complicated. And I think it is. I think it is. I mean, yes, like, just like we were saying, you know, marijuana in the early 80s was absolutely, you know, I don't know.
Worse than murder.
Worse than murder.
I mean, he I'm sure got swept up in that. In that, like, frenzy, the Reagan frenzy. Yeah.
That, I think that was a huge part of it. Yeah. You know, that worse than murder. And then now everybody smokes it. And it's like, you know, in the time frame, you know, it was such, just, I cannot emphasize enough that it was so different. You know, I talk a lot in the book about ideas of masculinity and what it meant to be a real man. Like, so different than from now. So it's like, I don't. No, so you know, this idea of a moral compass, right? I think I've come to understand, like, it's quite relative, not just to the person, but to the time, to the place, to the circumstance. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, so I don't have a good answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're obviously not, it's your father's actions, not yours, and it's, you know, it's in some ways, because you're here and he's not, you're kind of being asked to answer for his actions, which you couldn't possibly. If he were here, do you have things you would ask him, or do you feel like you kind of got your questions answered by writing this book?
That's a great question. You mean about the business itself?
Or... Really anything. Like, because you were so young. I just think of like you were such a little kid when he died. You didn't even really have the chance to like process even having him as a father, let alone everything else.
Yeah, I think much like you were saying, this idea that writers, we often don't know what we're writing about until someone else points it out to us.
Yeah.
I think that for me, my father, you know, after he died, he disappeared. Like, there was no record of my father in my life. No photos. No one talked about him. It was like I had never had a father. So I had no real sense of what our relationship had been like. I had no, almost, you know, virtually no memories of him. I couldn't have told you anything about him. And so I undertook this major investigation into my father's business and death. And then the first time that I see my brother Terry as an adult and his wife, who is so perceptive, and she was the one who had really saved a lot, newspapers, photos. And, you know, she said to me, we had this moment alone, just the two of us. She said, your father loved you, you know. And I think that was the moment I realized that was the question that I had been asking all along. I mean, all the other stuff is just set dressing in a way, right?
And that's so kind of her, because I'm sure your mother was sort of protecting herself and you.
Yes.
And didn't get into that too much.
She couldn't. I think, you know, I've always had a lot of grace for my mother, and now I have, I should say grace and respect. I mean, my mom's amazing, really tough human being. And now that I know what I know, I mean, like, you know, even more so. And yes, and I think being protective meant there wasn't a lot of room for, the big feels, right? I don't think you can do both in this world. Which is probably why I'm, you know, I have all the feels, but I'm not so great at self-protection. that's another topic. So there we go. Do you have any process questions? I love talking about process. Like, process is my favorite thing in the world.
I love process,
like,
too.
Right? I mean, no pressure if you don't, but I can talk about process all day.
Well, I love that you said it was first a memoir, then was it ever like... just an essay and then it got longer, or you knew it was going to, I mean, you knew it was a big story from the beginning. So I imagine it probably wasn't an essay.
That's a great question. Yeah, because you're right. I feel like so many, the seed of so many
memoirs, especially.
Is an essay. Yeah, but no, you're right. You're right. I think I knew from the first that this story was too big to be contained. And maybe that's it, because it's so complicated, right? Like, there's so many threads. It's not just like, oh, my father died in a plane crash. It's like, well, my father was also a big time smuggler. Oh, and also maybe was murdered. And also, you know, many other things. So.
Right. Yeah. How did you keep that all? Like, what was your process like for keeping all the threads straight?
Yeah, I mean, it was, well, I mean, thank you for asking these questions. I feel like it's like relaxing me so I can leave here like, oh, phew, we didn't get too emotional. We did. But thank you very much for this, by the way. I appreciate it. I feel like this is like a good, like a cool down session. Yeah. Okay. So let me answer that. So two things. I mean, one was a very tactile way. You know, I at sort of late stages of writing, once I had all the reporting done, I just set up camp in my guest room. And I would sit in the middle, and spread around me were all these different piles. You know, this is the Bahamian pile. This is the farm in Georgia pile. This is, you know. And so I would have newspaper articles and FOIA documents and all that stuff. So there was that. And then the second thing to say is that, you know, I feel like editors are sort of the unsung heroes of this industry. And, yeah, my editor was absolutely amazing. Just a dream. You know, everything you could want in an editor. And just she had such a great head for structure. Is head the right term? She had such a great eye. I don't know. She had such a great sense. Yeah, right. She has a sense for structure and, you know, sort of line by line. She could do everything. She's amazing.
Yes.
But, you know, she would be like, okay, this should be here. This should be here. And she could see it in a way that I couldn't.
Yes. Oh, that's fantastic. I know. I don't understand people who, like, don't want to be edited. I mean, they always make things a billion times better.
You're right. And people will say to you, you know, after a book comes out or whatever, they're like, oh, but were you edited too much? And yes, thank God.
Thank God. Right? Exactly.
Like, you don't want to read this, like, straight from me? No.
I know. And I really think that's the difference between... Like, anybody might have a good story, but how you tell it and how you, like you said, the structuring, as well as the line-by-line, you know, writing, but, like, that's what makes it a great read, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
I know. God bless them.
I know, right? And they get no, like, recognition.
I know.
They get no, it's so strange.
I know that people have started talking about putting, like, credits in the back of a book, like, like on a movie. You know, there's 20,000 people, whatever, who work on a movie, but they should. Like, who was the copy editor? Who was the editor?
Yes, exactly.
Who did the cover? I mean, I guess the cover design person sometimes gets a credit, but
even that you have to look for, right?
Yes.
You have to really know. You are so right. Credits would be
just put them in the last page.
Yeah. All right. We'll advocate for that.
I mean, I know some of them just like being behind the scenes, but they do such important work.
Yeah.
If you're a reader and a lover of books, like,
yeah,
they're just great.
Copy editors, I feel like, talk about.
Oh, my Lord.
No,
they save everyone's rear end. Because you just can't possibly, I mean, two heads are better than one. Three heads are better than two. Like, you just can't possibly see all the stuff that you're messing up or you just something. I don't know. I'm very passionate about this because I was just writing something the other day and I was like, I just put in something that I knew from my childhood or something. And then I looked at it later and I was like, I really don't know that to be true. Like, I need a real, like, outside person to verify this for me. And that's what they do, you know?
Yes.
Like, we think things are correct in our brain, but they're off. So often they're not.
So often. And it's like, yeah, you can be the most meticulous person in the world, but I wrote this essay sort of in the publicity for this book, and I talked about all the stray cats I would bring home. But I guess I had written all the straight cats. And I had read it. How many times had I read it? And thank goodness my editor caught it. And she's
right.
Like, I think you mean stray cats. And I was like, I sure did. So see, yeah, like things like that. But, you know, I'm careful. I'm a careful writer. I'm a clean writer. And even then.
You just don't see it.
I don't see it. So.
Oh, my goodness.
On that note.
All right. I think we can wrap it up. All right. That was Artis Henderson, the author of No Ordinary Bird. Artis, thank you so much for joining us in the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Buy the book from Macintosh Books through bookshop.org. We will have links at WGCU.org. Thank you for listening to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. This is WGCU FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.